Before I call our next case, my notes tell me that we may have some students here from Tomah High School. If they are here, would they stand, please? Well, very good. Welcome to the Supreme Court. Please be seated. We'd like to have you come and visit, especially high school students, because you learn a little bit more about how the court functions. You see us in action a little bit, and you've received information before they've come. This program is one that the Supreme Court operates in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. I'd like to introduce the court to the students that are here, too. So beginning on my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Justice Shirley Abrahamson on my right. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. On the far end of the bench is Justice Daniel Kelly. Justice Michael Gableman will come down and speak with the students and the other class that was here earlier after the conclusion of this argument. So if you can stick around, I'm sure he will have a lot of things to tell you about the court that you'll find interesting and useful. Anybody else that wants to come to this kind of a presentation is always welcome. Our courtroom is always open here at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So, with those introductory remarks out of the way, I'd like to call our second case, Melchert versus Pro Electric. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Attorney Rudolph Kuss, and I represent the petitioners, Dr. Melchert, Happy Hobby, and the Jones Trust, who are the owners and or tenants of a property on 127th and Capitol Drive in Brookfield, who suffered property damage as a result of a severed sewer lateral. I will be addressing the two issues presented for review today. One is that Wisconsin statute 89380 sub 4, which I'll sometimes refer to as the governmental immunity statute, does not immunize a government or any of its agents or employees for liability for causing damage through negligent construction work, including the severing of a sewer lateral at issue here. The second issue that I'll address is that Wisconsin statute 182.0175 sub 2, which we may sometimes refer to as the Digger's Hotline statute, creates a ministerial duty on behalf of an excavator to inspect all transmission facilities exposed during excavation to ascertain whether or not those facilities have been or may have been struck, damaged, dislocated, or disrupted, and third, to refrain from backfilling their excavation until the inspection has been completed and any necessary repairs have been completed. And the most important point that I feel I need to make today is that these are two separate issues, two separately alleged tortious acts, which should be separately analyzed under governmental immunity analysis in accordance with this court's decision in the MMSD versus City of Milwaukee
case. In order to have a claim under 182.01752, don't you have to show that Pro Electric had a reason to know there was a sewer lateral under the area they were digging in?
I don't read the statute to require that, Your Honor, because instead there's an affirmative duty on behalf of an excavator to inspect and to ascertain. So it doesn't require any notice, constructive or otherwise, that there are.
What you're telling me then is that's a strict liability statute.
Yes.
If you do anything there, you hit anything, even though people called Digger's Hotline. So if this, just say this lateral was put in without a permit, so nobody knows it's there. So you say this statute gives Pro Electric liability if they hit it, even though there would be no way they would know it was there. And they did everything they were supposed to do under Digger's hotline, and nobody marks it because nobody knows it's there. And if you put things in without a permit, that does happen sometimes. So what you're telling me then is that's it. They hit it, that's the end of the story.
Yes, because the statute creates a ministerial duty at a certain point in time. It doesn't matter whether they called Digger's hotline before they started their excavation. Instead, what the statute says is that before backfilling, at a specific point in time, they have a duty to inspect transmission facilities exposed during the excavation and to ascertain whether they have been struck or otherwise damaged.
But when the statute says exposed during excavation and ascertain if those facilities have been injured, that implies they had a reason to know that there was some kind of, and a sewer line is a transmission facility under the statute, so they had a reason to know that sewer line was there. Under the facts of this case, how did they have a reason? How did they have a reason to know?
I don't think that the statute requires that because it talks about what's exposed during excavation. It doesn't talk about what's exposed earlier on in the process through calling Digger's hotline.
I mean, they would obviously have a reason to know it if they saw it. They started digging. It's a clay pipe, I understand, and probably those kind that hook together as those clay pipes do. But in any case, doesn't matter. There's nothing in the record that I saw that shows that they saw it during excavation.
Right. They deny that they saw it. I mean, there are plenty of opportunities. This was, from my recollection of the record, a 14-foot deep hole,
sure.
2 foot, 6 inch wide, I believe, and the process involved augering and periodically cleaning out the auger as you're making the different digs. And they deny that they ever saw the
that
sewer
they ever
ladder.
Saw it, sure.
Right.
Okay.
But I still think it's an open question whether they complied with the statute and ascertained, actively inspected what might not have been obvious to them and ascertained whether a sewer lateral was in fact struck or damaged.
I have a question. This is a summary judgment, right?
Okay. Correct.
And it's done on the pleadings and any depositions and matters that are put into the record for the summary judgment, right?
Correct.
Okay. And the issue is whether there's a material issue of fact that has to go to trial or there is no material issue of fact that has to go to trial, right?
I'm with you, Your Honor.
Right. Well, that's good. And then if there's no material issue of fact, it's done as a matter of law, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, the two issues, I'm trying to analyze yours. 89384, the immunity, and that's a legal issue, right?
Correct.
And who has the burden of proof to show immunity?
The burden of proven immunity is on the defendant per this court's decision in Schauer Appraisals. They have to show that they're a government agent as that term's used in the statute.
Now, is there any factual issue, that material fact that is disputed by the parties at the hearing, at the trial court, that relates to 893.84, sub 4. Is there any material issue of fact?
It's more of a legal issue
on the
893.80 sub 4.
That's right. I think I didn't see it, but I wanted you to do it. Okay. Then we get to 182.0175, right?
Correct.
And this is the Digger's hotline provision. And there was a question asked of you and opposing counsel. I'll put it this way. Is there a dispute of fact relating to the Digger's hotline?
I believe there is.
Okay, tell me what, because I tried to, I looked at your brief very carefully about this, because I thought that was the tougher issue for you. I didn't find in your brief, in your discussion, what the material issue of fact was that you set forth in anything.
Whether or not they complied with the statute and did what they needed to do to ascertain...
Where did you say they didn't comply with it? What evidence is in the record that shows there's a material issue of fact between you?
All there is a denial from the contractor's president, who, from my knowledge, wasn't even on site, saying that we looked at the excavation.
Well, where do you say they didn't? The burden on this one is on you, isn't it?
The burden's on them initially to establish that there's no prima facie issue of fact, and an affidavit or deposition testimony from someone who wasn't even present when this work was being done and just...
Did you object on that basis to that affidavit?
I don't believe that I did, but, I mean, a claim was made that the engineer was looking down the hole at the time that the hole was open. There's no affidavit from the engineer. There's no affidavit from the workers for the contractor who actually performed the work.
Your complaint just states they were negligent. No facts given about the drilling, no facts given that they did or didn't comply with the digger's hotline, nothing, right? Isn't that right?
Correct.
Okay. So where in the material you submitted or was submitted shows no compliance with the digger's hotline and negligence? I think the burden is on you to show that. I think the burden is on the other side to show your first course of action.
And I don't recall, I don't know that compliance with the Digger's Hotline statute per se was an issue that was litigated before the trial court.
Right. Okay, well, if it's not the Digger's Hotline per se, what was before the trial court that would show negligence or that 182.0175 was not compliant with? That's your, if I understand your argument today, it's 182.0175 sub 2 wasn't complied with, and that's negligence, and that they are liable because that's discretionary if you go for that far.
Right, right.
And that's your argument? Have
right.
I stated it?
Right. I mean, there's no firsthand testimony of anyone who was actually involved in the augering.
What do you need that for summary judgment? Do you need firsthand testimony?
Well, I think they need it for summary judgment to establish their entitlement to it, that they would need an affidavit from an engineer or from the individuals who are doing the augering work saying, look, this is what we did to ascertain whether any transmission facilities were struck and damaged, and we didn't find anything.
And did you bring in anything that disputed that affidavit?
I did not have an opportunity to depose the engineer, no.
But the standard would be taken in light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Which would be, yes, us, correct. And I think it's also important to note, additionally, that Pro-Electric Contractors didn't act as a governmental agent for the statutory purposes in its performance of the duties under the Digger's Hotline statute. This is a duty that's imposed on excavators, not on the government itself. So it's not something where they're acting on behalf of the government. And these activities were separate from its original activities as far as augering the hole, drilling it for the installation of the stoplight.
Now, you've moved to the first argument, have you, in making this argument that they're not an agent?
The first argument being the governmental immunity?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, did you, is that what your point is here, that it's not a government agent?
No. I'm arguing that as far as the Diggers Hotline claim, that they, you know, once they dug the hole, that they didn't do enough to ascertain that any transmission facilities were struck before backfilling the excavation, that duty, that their performance of that duty wasn't one that they didn't act as a government agent in the performance of that duty, for lack of a better phrase.
So basically your argument on that point is there's no immunity available for poor workmanship.
Correct. Well, that's my argument as far as the initial augering so that they could install the stoplight.
All right. So let me take you back perhaps a half a step. There's been a fair amount of discussion about the DOT having identified the precise location at which the concrete base was to be located. Is that correct?
Right.
Right. And yet in ProElectric's brief, they identify HNTB as having discretion with respect to determining the ultimate placement. Did you see that? Page 6 of their brief?
In ProElectric's brief, they said that they had discretion in where they placed the stoplight?
In page 6, they say HNTB, a private engineering firm, was hired by the DOT to supervise ProElectric's work on the project and to ensure ProElectric's compliance with the DOT's plan specifications. The DOT plans give HNTB authority to determine the final location of installations.
So there was some discretion involved, potentially.
I don't know. Were you able to inquire into that before the circuit court?
No, I wasn't, Your Honor.
Well, you didn't sue this in-between person anyway, right? You just sued ProElectric. So whether they had discretion to exercise on behalf of DOT or not is not what you're arguing about. You're arguing about negligence that you say ProElectric.
Correct.
To shoulder the responsibility for it.
But you have to get past the immunity first.
Right. I have to get past the immunity on the tortious act of augering through the sewer lateral.
If HNTB had discretion on where ultimately to place the concrete base, would that sever the DOT's immunity? That is, let me rephrase that. That was imprecise. If HNTB had the authority to designate the ultimate location of the concrete base, does that mean that the actual location of the concrete base was the exercise of a private entity's discretion rather than DOT's?
Arguably, I think it does mean that.
But weren't they operating as the agent of DOT when they exercised that discretion?
And in an extent... expanded way, I mean, ProElectric Contractors is being argued to be the government's agent.
Of course, that's the central argument for immunity.
Exactly.
It'd be the same argument against HNPD.
Right, right.
And on that, just to follow up on the Chief's question, 893.80 sub 4 immunizes the exercise of legislative, quasi-legislative, judicial, or quasi-judicial functions.
Right.
Does is it possible for a private entity to exercise legislative or quasi-legislative functions?
I wouldn't think so, no. But I think the larger point, which I made the focus of this petition, is that regardless of who does it, that there shouldn't be immunity for this type of construction work where it results in the severing of a sewer lateral that causes damage to a private property owner.
So even if DOT had its own engineers state employees and they did it, you think that the state would be liable?
Yes, and I think that in a way the lower courts have given pro-electric contractors more immunity than what the government would be entitled to itself, which conflicts obviously with this court's decision in Schauer's appraisals. And the way that I think that the lower courts have done this is artificially separating the functions of design and performance. The line of reasoning goes, well, the DOT told them where to dig, told them how far to dig, and they were just following the DOT's marching orders, and that means that they vicariously get the government's liability. And I really think that that expands governmental immunity much further than where it was intended to go. Here, if you had a local public works department or the Department of Transportation itself, and it just started augering a hole for a stoplight and it severed a sewer lateral, I don't think that 89380 sub 4 gives them immunity for that, especially in light of this court's discussion in Schauer appraisals, where it specifically discusses negligent excavation as something that's not entitled to immunity. And this court in Schauer's appraisals specifically disagreed with the Court of Appeals that a governmental contractor can qualify for immunity simply by proving that it was an agent under the Lyons test. But reading the Court of Appeals decision in this case, I don't see how the Court of Appeals has altered its analysis at all. It still focuses on whether the relevant decision was made by the government or by the contractor itself. And this rationale conflicts with Schauer's appraisals, and that presents a real problem going forward, because this court in Schauer's appraisals said that it was providing guidance to future litigants and to courts on how to resolve issues like this, that it's a two-part inquiry, that the contractor has to prove that it's an agent under the Lyons test and also has to prove that the injury-causing act was a legislative, quasi-legislative, judicial, or quasi-judicial act in character. And the Court of Appeals decision in this case is an authored decision that can be cited in any court in this state as persuasive authority, and as persuasive authority for the proposition that the two-part test that this court set forth in Schauer's appraisals is really a one-part test, because all you have to do is prove that the DOT provided you with reasonably precise specifications and that you complied with them.
Okay, so you don't think the specifications from DOT were reasonably precise, correct?
No, I do think they were. I have no dispute with the fact that the DOT specifications were reasonably precise, and I have no basis for refuting that they followed them to a T.
Okay.
The problem is that you can comply with reasonably precise specifications. You can give the DOT what it wants. You can give it a stoplight at this exact location on the corner of 128th and Capitol in Brookfield, but do it in a way in which you damage private property. And there's a risk with this construction work in the field that the manner that you go about doing this, that it endangers private property if it's done improper.
Counsel, if it's a, if this truly is the exercise of legislative or quasi-legislative authority, doesn't your remedy sound in takings rather than in negligence?
That's a theory I haven't considered, Your Honor. I mean, what we have here is a negligence case for damages against a private contractor who damaged my client's sewer lateral. We've never pursued a case against the DOT. We've never sought any damages from the DOT for taking property without just compensation, if that's what you're implying.
It is.
But I think that there, regardless of if there's a remedy under that provision, I still think that the law should recognize a remedy for negligent construction work causing damage. If Pro-Electric contractor had been hired by my neighbor to do some work on my on the easement between our two properties and somehow caused damage to my property as a result, I would clearly be able to hold Pro-Electric liable for damaging my property. The only difference here is that Pro-Electric was doing work on one of the many public construction sites in this state. And
I want to test a little bit the specificity of the plans and the consequences of having a specific plan. Let's change the facts just a wee bit and assume the DOT knew the sewer lateral was there, and they said, I want to drill that spot right there anyway. Would that decision be immunized?
No. No. I mean, again, I don't think it matters whether they knew or not, because regardless, excavating, doing negligent construction work, and augering through a sewer lateral shouldn't be immune, but especially under that circumstance where the DOT or the contractor actually knows.
Right. So when we speak in terms of immunity for governmental entities, the reason we do that is because we say they're balancing interests and they're entitled to immunity for how the balancing of interests results. So if they look at this and they say, well, I know there's a sewer lateral there, but it's really important to have a stoplight at that spot, yeah, we balanced that interest and we decided to go ahead and drill right there. Wouldn't that fall within the parameters of immunity?
Would that fall within the parameters of, I'm sorry?
Immunity.
I see my time's up, but I can answer your question.
Yes, please do.
Okay. I mean, no, I don't see any way that balancing of interest would justify immunity to the DOT or to any governmental contractor.
Thank you. You have about 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Rick Hills. I'm here for the respondents. With me in court is Attorney Amy Fryman. I believe that in listening to the prior argument, I can see why the court is confused as to why we're here on certain issues. We think that this is a case that just merely is a specific set of facts that requires an application of showers. And that's exactly what the circuit court did. That's exactly what the Court of Appeals did. They have conceded that we were an agent. They have conceded that there were specific directions on how to go about doing the project. They have conceded that we actually did it exactly the way they told us to do it.
So, counsel, let me ask you the question that I just asked Mr. Coos. If DOT knew the sewer lateral was there and decided to auger through it anyway, would that decision still be immune from liability?
What I would be required to do as the contractor, because then it would show up on the plans, under the Lyons test, is to tell the city about a known danger. And that would protect me under the Lyons test. And that's where my concern would be.
Right.
In terms of the DOT's immunity, that would be a balancing test that they're making on going after something and that they know it's there and that they're going to damage it.
Well, you share the DOT's immunity. Isn't that your argument?
Correct.
All right. So if the DOT does not have immunity, neither do you.
If the DOT has immunity, I have the immunity. I'm saying that I would be able to maintain my immunity by telling the DOT of the danger. they would have the immunity because they made that decision. So but it's their balancing based right. upon what they see.
So yeah, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on your answer. So the DOT could decide to auger, intentionally auger through a sewer lateral and be immune to that decision?
Arguably, yes, because they did a balancing test, but they're not going to do that in real life. I mean, it's a great hypothetical, but they're not going to do that in real life.
It's a hypothetical because there's not been an allegation of intentional wrongdoing. There's been an allegation of negligent wrongdoing. So my question goes to whether you get immunity for negligence but not immunity for intentional.
That's correct.
So what's the answer?
You get immunity for negligence, not intentional, because even the statute says that you can't do, you're not immune for intentional conduct.
Right.
Mr. Hills, one question that came to my mind when I was preparing for this case, we're here on summary judgment, and so the factual record has not been comprehensively developed. There's nothing to indicate what anybody saw, what any of the contractors on the site observed after they completed installation or the augering in preparation for the installation of the traffic control signal. I think that's my recollection. Right?
The record is what the record is, and that's what the court accepted. It was.
There's no track being laid, Mr. Hills. I'm just saying, right?
Well, yes.
Okay. Well, so I'm just asking. Okay, so
the parties accepted certain facts as true as presented by Pro-Electric Contractors affidavit.
I've presided over any number of summary judgment motions in my 6 years as a trial lawyer. I know what this means. But my question is this. So right now I assume that all of the workers at the site, you know, did what responsible workers would do and say follow safety and follow all of the normal things that good faith people would do in such a circumstance. But what happens if down the road, so to speak, there's a case that comes before us where the record is developed a little further, and there's an affidavit attached in the motions for summary judgment, and there's a record where the workers on the site did see, and this is a little bit like what Justice Kelly was asking, but maybe a little, this is the question that came to my mind. And they did look down in the hole, and they did see that they had punctured the lateral, and they saw the waste coming up. I wondered to myself, well,
then you have a negligence case.
Do what?
Then you have a negligence case. I even wrote down when he talked about trying to say performance, if we would have dug down 16 feet instead of 14 feet and hit a sewer at 15 feet,
yes,
we would have been responsible because we would not have followed the precise specifications that were given by the Department of Transportation.
No, but my assumption is that the workers here would have followed DOT's directives to the T. It's just that the only difference is that there would have been an affidavit saying that the workers, before they left the job site, before they filled in the hole, looked down and observed it and said, oh, well, we followed DOT's specs, immunity, we're covered, fill it in, boys.
No, I think that I would agree at that point in time that there's a negligence argument.
Why?
Because at that point in time, they became aware of a problem that was outside the scope of the specifications and didn't fix it.
But they followed the specs.
They followed the specs, and then they came across the problem that then the other statute kicks in, and they have to see it, identify it, and give the owner a chance to fix it, is what they have to do under the statute.
So isn't there then a factual question about...
Not in this case, because they never created a factual question. Once we filed our motion for summary judgment, it was incumbent upon them. They said they didn't depose the engineer. They could have deposed the engineer. Everybody knows that as a trial judge that you can say, I need more time to develop the facts in this case. They did not do that. As a matter of fact, the only thing that they did to try to bring an element of negligence into this case was to file an affidavit attaching the president of our company's deposition transcript. And there was nothing in that deposition transcript that said that he did anything wrong in following through on what the DOT told him to do. They've already conceded that in their original argument. That's the problem with the appellant's position in this case. The record is the one that they created. I think the court is bound by the record and has to make a decision on the record as it's been presented. And it's for that reason that we prevail on both issues, because they've conceded we're an agent. They've conceded that DOT provided specific means of how to go about doing it. They admitted that we did it exactly the way DOT told us to.
Counsel,
and then, as Your Honor, I had it
counsel,
written down in my Justice Rogensack.
Counsel, if I might interrupt. On page 6 and again on page 20 of your brief, you indicate that the DOT plans give HNTB authority to determine the final location of the installations. By installations, you're referring to the concrete base?
Yes.
HNTB is a private entity? Yes?
They are the agent. They're an engineer that's the agent of the DOT.
Right. So is it possible for a private entity acting as an agent for DOT to exercise legislative or quasi-legislative authority?
They could make a decision based upon what they saw in the field to tell us to move something, but that didn't happen in this case.
Okay. But doesn't that authority mean that DOT's immunity no longer attaches because a private entity has the discretion on where to put the concrete base?
You're talking apples and oranges, because the DOT in this case engineer did not do that.
But he had the authority to.
Just because they had the authority to do something doesn't mean they acted on it. You have to act on something in order to make a discretionary decision.
Counsel, isn't it generally the case in construction projects that the government agency, whether it's DOT or some other agency, always has an engineer on site because things are not always as you write them up in the plans?
Exactly.
And that's what change orders result from generally, isn't it?
Correct. I could discuss some of those things, but they're not part of the record.
Right.
And I was hampered by that in some of the discussions I had with my client before we made this presentation. But we have to decide this case based upon the record as it exists. And the point I wanted to make that Justin Rogensack brought up is I had written the words, this is not a strict liability statute, down on my papers when I was preparing my argument here today, because that's not how statutory construction works. If the legislature wanted to make it a strict liability, they would have said any time you hit something in a hole, you're responsible.
Right.
And that's not what the statute says, and that's not what my client was required to do under the circumstances as they existed back
then. But that's how we have to interpret it, to hold your client liable, because there's no record that anybody saw anything. They called the digger's hotline. They didn't identify anything, and nothing was posted or marked that you disregarded, correct?
Correct.
So if you're going to be liable under that statute, we have to interpret it as strictly imposing liability. You hit it, you bought it, it's yours, right?
I agree.
Okay.
What does the record show? This matter was before Judge Kiefer, and as I reviewed the record, the digger's hotline issue did arise before the judge, and he focused on the wording of whether or not it was, quote, exposed, unquote, as required in 182. That was my recollection of the record, that there was a discussion of the digger's hotline, and he said there was nothing exposed here. No issue of fact as to whether anything was exposed. Tell me, is my recollection of the record correct or incorrect?
No, and that's correct. And one of the points that I wanted to make is that the reasonably precise specifications that were given by the DOT actually created a situation where you wouldn't be able to see it. It's a 2.5 foot wide hole, and it's 14 feet deep, which stack up one more of me and then add another 2 feet on top of it. And you got an auger going down the middle that's bringing out clay. And the only testimony in the record is that clay that's coming out is the same substance as we learned months later that the auger ultimately hit. So because this was not a trenching situation, which was the photos they showed later, which was a much larger hole where they identified the problem, the parties that were doing the work weren't in a position to see or to observe or to even comprehend that the auger had struck an empty clay ladle.
Did the specifications require augering? And let me ask additionally, did the specifications provide for trenching?
No, specifications required augering, and they required a 2-foot, 6-inch wide hole, 14 feet deep. That's specific, and that's what was done.
And about trenching, was there anything in the specifications that would complement the auger with trenching?
No. I believe I've addressed the issues that I have for the court, and unless there's any other specific questions, I believe I've covered my points.
Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Counsel.
If it may please the court, I'd like to address the issue further on whether, after establishing that a contractor is an agent for the purposes of the immunity statute, whether or not there can still be liability. And under these circumstances, I think that there still needs to be liability for negligent construction work, even if the contractor followed the reasonably precise specifications that were given, because there's work in the field, construction work, that still creates the risk of damaging private property, even when it's done exactly the way that the DOT requests, such as excavation work, drilling, even demolition work. One situation that is commonly encountered, in addition to augering that damages a sewer lateral, are when you demolish a building, it creates a risk that foundations can be damaged in neighboring properties. And we can't apply governmental contractor immunity in a way that simply says, like the Estate of Lyons case used to be read, that as long as you comply with the reasonably precise specifications, that there can't be any liability whatsoever. There have to be specific examples of construction work, or broadly, negligent construction work, augering, and excavation that can leave a contractor open to liability regardless of how much they complied with the governmental agency specifications. Unless the court has any questions, I'd simply ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals and send Dr. Melcher's case back to the Circuit Court.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for very interesting arguments. You know, when you try to do construction work or contracting work of any time, there are always surprises for both sides. Your briefs were very good. They were very helpful. We are going to take a break now until 1:30, when we will reconvene for our third case of the day. But before that time, Justice Michael Gableman will come and chat with the students, if you all can stay a little bit. And anyone else who'd like to stay is certainly welcome as well. We are adjourned.